Good morning, everyone. We're so glad to have you all here today, back for our reunions series. Today, we're honored to have Dr. Dennis T. Olson with us today, talking about the Joseph story, right?
That's right.
Great. Dennis T. Olson is the Charles T. Haley Professor of Old Testament Theology, and he's has been chair of the Biblical Studies Department at Princeton Theological Seminary. He earned his MDiv from Luther Theological Seminary and his MA, MPhil, is that Master's of Philosophy?
Yes.
Okay, great. And PhD from Yale University. Dennis is an ordained Lutheran minister, and he specializes in the Pentateuch and other narrative literature of the Old Testament. So this morning, as usual, Thais is going to pop up during our time together and take a picture of all of us for contact tracing purposes. And I think with that, we're ready to hand it over to Dr. Olson. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Good to be here. Thank you very much. delighted to be here. Is this too loud or is this okay? Okay, good. Our story here today is the Joseph story, which is one of the most beautifully crafted narratives of the Old Testament. And I want to look at it today in terms of focusing on chapters 42 to 45, which is one part. So the story of Joseph goes from chapter 37 through 50. So it's a long, long story. We're going to take a look at, focus more on 42 to 45, which involves two reunions of Joseph and his brothers coming together, and two tests in their relationship that are being brought together as well. So our theme is God and the long road from revenge to forgiveness in the the long road from revenge to forgiveness in the Joseph story. And I want to look at the notion of revenge and forgiveness. Joseph begins as a favored son of Jacob, the father, and the brothers are jealous of Joseph. And the story takes us to a point where they come together later when Joseph is in power and has a capacity to take revenge for his on his brothers or to forgive them. And so we want to look at how we get along that journey along the way. First, just a few biblical texts to think about this topic of revenge and forgiveness. And there are diverse sort of notions within the Bible itself that treat this. One is from Romans 12, quoting from Deuteronomy, an Old Testament book, 32. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, God says, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. And so there the suggestion is humans are not to take vengeance on one another, but allow God to bring judgment upon those as God wills. On the other hand, there is also within the Bible, here in Exodus and Leviticus, Deuteronomy as well, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life. So if someone hurts someone in some way, then there should be punishment that isn't equal to it. Now, it sounds harsh, but in the Old Testament, ancient context, it was a way by which vengeance and consequences was limited, realizing that as humans bring vengeance upon one another, it often spirals out of control, and there is no way to stop it and can become more and more severe and thus destroy the community. And so this is a way to limit it. So it's a kind of limited notion of consequences for wrong actions. Then in Matthew 5, the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, quoting an Old Testament text. But Jesus says to you, do not resist an evildoer, but if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. So a kind of total pacifist response, not to take any kind of action against someone who might hurt you. And then this text, wonderful, from Matthew 18, Peter came and said to Jesus, "Lord, if another member of the church sins against me, how often should I forgive? As many as seven times?" And Peter's thinking, he's being very generous here, right? That someone hurts him seven times, you know, should I do that? Jesus says, no, you, not seven times, but I tell you, 77 times. Just keep forgiving each other along the way. So there are these diverse traditions within the Old Testament, the Bible, and New Testament that talk about revenge and forgiveness. So we want to think about these factors within the Joseph story itself. Before we do that, though, I want to take a look at some scientific understandings of revenge and forgiveness. So to think about what we're doing, we're going with one lens, we're going to look at sort of a scientific view of revenge and forgiveness in human beings and what anthropologists, sociologists tell us, and then look at the biblical material in the book of Joseph, in the story of Joseph. First of all, there, as we think about siblings, and the Joseph story is about sibling relationships within a family, but also more on that, as we'll see, there's a wide variety of, as scientists have noticed, of relationships among siblings in the animal world. So on one hand, you have an extreme like honeybees in a honeycomb with a queen bee. They're all related. And what scientists notice about bees is when their colony is attacked, they will sacrifice themselves for the sake of the whole community. And so if a group of hornets come in, hornets are big, they're aggressive, and they're predatorial on honeybees and on their honey, the honeybees will try to stop them knowing that they're, well, without knowing, but they just instinctively react by attacking the hornet, and the hornet will kill most of them. And so, but they are willing to sacrifice themselves for the sake of the whole. The other extreme of sibling relationships in the animal world is illustrated by a certain type of large blackbird, a mountain blackbird, who lives in the context of high up in the mountains where there are few resources, food resources for these birds. And the typical way in which they reproduce is that the mother bird lays typically two eggs in a season. And so one egg is laid, and then a week or two later, a second egg is laid. And what happens is the first egg obviously hatches first, and that first fledgling gets all the food while the other one is unhatched. And then when the little one, the younger one, hatches, the older sibling begins to peck at the younger one and steals all the food and does so until the big one, the older one, kills the younger fledgling so that only one is left. That's horrible. Now, evolutionists wonder what's the function of that. And the function is that they surmise that in that very sparse mountainous kind of terrain where there isn't much food, there's only enough resources for one. So why have two then? Well, it's sort of a guarantee. In case something goes wrong with the oldest egg or it doesn't hatch or whatever, there is this second one that emerges as and keeps the species going in that context. So another extreme way of thinking about sibling relationships. So where do humans fit in with all of that? There's an interesting book by Michael McCullough, Beyond Revenge, The Evolution of the Forgiveness Instinct. And he looks scientifically at the notion of revenge and forgiveness and how that functions in human societies and human evolution. He asks the question about human beings. And there's debate among anthropologists and so on. Are humans at our deepest nature good-natured? Are we at our core, in our DNA, in our hardwiring of our brain, are we good natured? And so this picture of Franz de Waal, they study primates, and primates are very kind to each other within their group. They groom each other, they share food, and so they're very cooperative and so forth. And so de Waal said, yeah, humans are like that, and we can extrapolate and suggest we're all basically at our core good-natured. Then But others didn't feel that way. So Wrangham and Peterson have a book called Demonic Males, right? So apes in and the origins of human violence. And so there they see humans as, at our very core, very violent. Some even talk about an aggression gene along the way. Agustin Fuentes is an evolutionary anthropologist at the University of Notre Dame. And he's a wonderful scholar who tries to be very interdisciplinary to think about human beings and their nature, thinking about human evolution and development, our biology, our psychology, brings all those disciplines together. And he notes that in the majority of the 2 million years of human evolution, that there was almost no evidence of killing or organized violence or war over the majority of that time from the fossil record in terms of finding bones and how they might have died and so forth. And he notes that it's only in the last 10 to 12,000 years where the picture changes in the fossil record and there is more evidence of human violence and even organized warfare in the bones that they find. And he notes that what our human brains and our DNA have changed very little in that time over the last many thousands of years. But what has changed is the structure of the world, how we structure our communities, our societies, what we learn from one another, and so forth. And his argument is that aggression is not part of our DNA and our core. There is no sort of one place that it's located in our brain, but it's a confluence of various factors. And so what he says much more important about the human species at our core is that we have the capacity to cooperate, to collaborate with one another, and that's been the secret of human flourishing on the planet. And it's our big brains, ability to think, but also to cooperate, to teach new generations, to share parenting duties and share that with others. Language involves cooperation, building tools and cities, and creativity and adaptability. That's how we flourish along the way. And so the conclusions from this scientific material, one could talk a lot about all of this, but I just want to get a few things out. First is the desire for revenge is deeply ingrained in us. It did have a certain positive function within primitive human societies. Because it encouraged cooperation among the in-group. If you were a slacker, there were consequences to that, and it would bring you back in and function, because every community needed everyone functioning well within the community that's there. And there was attacks from the outside. There was the threat of revenge, kept safety for the group, and so there is that function. But in our more civilized society of laws and law enforcement, and judicial systems, and so forth, this kind of notion of revenge that we have within us, and that our brains release chemicals that when there's revenge against those that we see as threatening, that doesn't function as well, but it's still in us. You go to a football game, there's still revenge, right? So tackle him, get him. So, you know, and you go to a movie, and there's often the storyline, right, of a villain and takes the lead actor or actress down, and then at the very end, there's that satisfying, so that the villain gets theirs. And that creates a feeling within us. We're hardwired to like that kind of story of revenge and so forth. The other conclusion, though, is that the capacity for forgiveness is deeply ingrained within us as well. That has had a long function within us as human beings and human societies to restore, to reconcile, to cooperate, and bring together us. And so these are scientific conclusions, but as Christians, we can also say God has built these into us and our capacities. And then finally, a conclusion that humans have a deeply ingrained instinct to adapt. Again, this is sort of a human superpower, the ability to take on the crises, the challenges before us, and to adapt to them. So Darwin says it's not the strongest of the species that survives, not the most intelligent, it's the one that is most adaptable to change. And that can give us some hope, as we'll see in the Joseph story. All right, so now we want to go to a second lens, a biblical to a theological lens, thinking about our faith. What does the story of Joseph, Judah, and their brothers teach us about revenge and forgiveness? First, just to observe the sort of family system into which Joseph and the brothers exist. So Jacob is the patriarch. His wife, Rachel, has died as we begin the Joseph story. But Jacob had two wives, Leah, who was the unfavored one, and Rachel, the favored. So last time we talked about Jacob and Esau, right, and some of the tensions between them, because Jacob was the favored son of Rebekah, and Esau, the favored son of Isaac. So this dysfunction has happened over the course of multi-generations. So there are these collection of the sons of Leah form a group from the unfavored wife. And the way the narrative functions is that these sons are sort of seen as the unfavored sons in some ways. Joseph and Benjamin, at least in Jacob's eyes, are the favored sons because they were the only two direct offspring of his favored wife, Rachel. And so given that, you have this sort of conflict now, potential conflict that's baked into this family system that's there. And then there are also the concubines, Bilhah and Zilpah, who also had children as well. So there is a sense of hierarchy and favoritism and unfavoritism within this family system, which can be difficult. Now, this also reflects not only family dynamics in ancient Israel, but also tribal, political, and national relationships. And so one might observe about the Joseph story, it's about a family, but it's also about the community of all Israel. And it may have functioned most significantly in its final form at a time after the Babylonian exile, when Israel was conquered by the Babylonians and diaspora spread out in Egypt and Babylon, and then later in the Persian period in Persia, and all these different communities, and some of them came back home, and some were, so that there were all kinds of different groups. And so just as the Jacob family is split up, disparate, potential conflicts, so Israel itself experienced that in its history as a people. And so in some ways, this family story reflects some of the dynamics that are there. Now in your handout, there is this little chart. Somebody said, it looks like we're gonna play bingo, but we're not gonna play bingo. But this sort of gives us a very quick overview of the Joseph story in each of these columns and the kind of symmetry that's in each of these along the way. So the story begins with Jacob, who is the father, sort of, and then Joseph is the favored son, kind of jeopardy, second in person, and then the other subjects are brothers. So that's how the story begins. Joseph has a beautiful coat that the father gives him as a sign of favoritism. Joseph has dreams about how great he's going to be and exalted, and all his brothers are going to bow down to him. And so this coat becomes, in the second column, the long sleeve robe, a sign of favoritism. But the brothers decide one day when Joseph comes out to see them, the brothers are working, they're herding sheep. Joseph is just hanging out at home, and his father sends him, just check on them for me, would you? Be, you know, so like a spy, so, you know. And so Joseph does, and the brothers are angry, both at the dreams about how great Joseph's gonna be and about this robe and the favoritism that he has. And so they plot first to kill Joseph, and then the brother Reuben, the oldest of all the brothers, says, no, let's not kill him, let's just throw him into a pit. and just let him languish there, and because we don't want to actually spill his blood. So Reuben had planned to come back, but then Reuben leaves apparently, and then the brothers decide, you know, let's get some money out of this. Let's sell Joseph as a slave. So take him out of the pit and sell him to some traders who are passing by. And then they bring the long sleeve robe of Joseph back to their father. They've soaked it in goat's blood and they show it to their father, and the father says, oh, a wild animal has killed Joseph. That's what happened to him. So the brothers don't have to lie exactly, they don't deny, obviously they've deceived their father. So this long sleeve robe, a sign of exaltation, but then also a sign of his death and transition, and the pit being in the place both where his life is spared in a sense, but he's also sold as a slave. So then the next column, Potiphar is an Egyptian official, and Joseph rises because of his abilities to become head of the household of this royal official, Potiphar, and the other servants, Joseph is over them. And then there is an episode in which Potiphar's wife asked to have sexual relations with Joseph. Joseph runs away, but she grabs his cloak and then uses that as evidence that this servant had tried to come to her. And so Joseph is thrown into prison. He's into prison. It's both a place now of ill fortune, but also a place where his abilities to dream, interpret dreams, becomes known. And so Pharaoh has some dreams about 7 years of plenty and 7 years of starvation, and Joseph can interpret them, and then Joseph is raised up again and becomes second in command under Pharaoh and sort of vice president of food distribution in all the land of Egypt and all the international world of nations that come to Egypt for food that's there. So that's just a kind of, but it gives us a glimpse too of the sort of carefully crafted narrative story and the way in which this exaltation and falling down along the way that's there. So that brings us then to thinking about the story of Joseph and the encounters between the brothers and Joseph. As we do that though, we keep in mind this theological, where's God in all of this? And the Joseph story is very subtle about thinking theologically about how God is active in, with, and under all of these tangled, dysfunctional family dynamics along the way. And so the complexity even of God's character. In Exodus 34, there is this summary of the character of God. This is after the golden calf, and on what basis is God going to continue after the idolatry of the golden calf in the book of Exodus. And God reveals God's own character, deep character. God is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love to the thousandth generation, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin. And so the overwhelming mercy of God, forgiveness of God, that's emphasized for thousands of generations, yet by no means clearing the guilty. There are consequences to disobedience and things so that God has built into the sort of moral fabric and texture of human existence and reality. So visiting the iniquity of the parents upon the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. So thinking about the generations, Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob, and Rachel, and then the brothers as well. So thinking theologically about how God works in and through consequences of disobedience, but also forgiveness at the same time. So now let's turn to the Joseph story itself. We're now at a point where Joseph is in Egypt. He's second in command. He's doling out food to all the Egyptians and all the nations that come. And it is a point at which Jacob's sons, the brothers of Joseph, have found themselves starving, and so they need to go from Canaan in the north and go down to Egypt to get food because they've heard there's food there for them. So what's Joseph's sort of feeling about his past family? In Genesis 41:51, his firstborn he names Manasseh. In the Bible, sometimes names have meaning. And Manasseh, from the Hebrew verb nasa, to forget, and Joseph tells us the reason why that Joseph gives the name of his firstborn son as Manasseh. God has made me forget all my hardship. I'm doing pretty well right now. And all my father's house. I've put my family out of my mind, forgotten about them, moved on. But then Genesis 42, the family comes back into Joseph's face. When Jacob learned there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you keep looking at one another? Go down to Egypt and buy grain." But Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers. So Benjamin, remember, the one remaining son of his favored wife, he will not let go to go there. And then 42:6, Joseph was governor over the land. He was he who sold food to all the people, and Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. So they acknowledge this person who they don't recognize yet as their brother, as someone with great power that they need, from whom they will receive food. And then at the end of the text, Joseph also remembered the dreams that he had dreamed about those brothers, that dream of 10 sheaves of grain, the 10 brothers bowing down to the one sheaf of grain, Joseph, or the other dream of the second dream, the sun, father Jacob, and moon, mother Rachel, and 11 stars, all bowing down to the central star, Joseph, in Genesis 37. Joseph remembers those dreams, and now his family is there. So he can't forget them now. So he has to deal with, what do I do with them? So his reaction is pretty negative in Genesis 42. To this is not, you know, all just embracing them right away. Joseph says to the brothers, "You are spies. You've come to see the nakedness of the land. You're here to do bad things." And they said to him, no, we're just here to buy food. And then they tell the story about being the sons of a certain man in Canaan. The youngest is now with our father, Benjamin, and one of the sons is no more, Joseph. Of course, Joseph is right there, and so here's this. But Joseph says, no, you are spies. Here's how you shall be tested. So you have to bring your youngest brother back from Canaan here in order that the words may be tested, seeking whether you are true in your saying that all you want is grain. More the truth is that Joseph is interested in is, have the brothers changed from what they did to him? Would they be willing to bring Benjamin to them, and how would they do that? So test number one for these brothers. Joseph puts all the brothers in prison for 3 days to sort of stew over this. And the test is this: let one of you go and bring your brother while the rest of you remain in prison here. So all the brothers stay here except one of you that you have to choose, and then we'll go get your other brother. But then Joseph sort of has a touch of mercy and says on the third day, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God." And that is as an Egyptian. Now Joseph is sort of masquerading and with people from other nations or other religions, to say that they fear God means that even though they worship other gods, perhaps they are sort of humane and fear God in that way. And so, "I fear God. If you're honest men, let one of your brothers stay here, and the rest of you shall go and bring your youngest brother to me." And he chooses Simeon, who's one of the brothers, and they agreed to do so. And then they said to one another, and here's the first step towards forgiveness: "Alas, we are paying the penalty for what we did to our brother. We saw his anguish when he pleaded with us, but we would not listen. That's why this anguish has come upon us." So So they confess that they were wrong in what they did to their brother Joseph years and years ago. And then Reuben answered them, "Did I not tell you not to wrong the boy? But you wouldn't listen, so now there comes a reckoning for his blood. Now these are consequences. We are thrown into prison." They did not know that Joseph understood them, since he spoke with them through an interpreter. So Joseph pretends not to understand the Hebrew that they're speaking, that he's an Egyptian speaker and needs an interpreter to understand it, but he hears exactly what they've said. And so he hears this first confession from them. And when he hears that confession, Joseph turns away from his brothers and wept. There's a lot of weeping by Joseph in this story at various places along the way. He's beginning to crumble a bit. And so then he sends them off. But what he does is has all the money that was paid for the food put into the sacks of the brothers. And they discover that, and they tremble because they know it seems like they've stolen that money, although they didn't do it, but Joseph had sort of set that up. And they said, "What is this that God has done to us? These are the consequences. And now, but we have to come back to Joseph with the brother, or do we just allow Simeon and not go back," right? These are the sort of struggles they have to go through. Will they pass the test? And so they come to their father, and they reveal they have to bring the brother Benjamin, and they also have the money back that they had paid originally. And the father Jacob says, "I'm the one you have bereaved of children. Joseph is no more," Jacob says, the father. "Simeon is no more. He's stuck in Egypt, and now you would take Benjamin." And Jacob says, "No." Reuben offers, "You may kill my two sons if I do not bring Benjamin back to you, if we take him, but absolutely not." Jacob says, "No." The famine grows more intense. They're forced to go back. And then Judah says to his father, "Send the boy Benjamin with me and let us be on our way so that we may live and not die." They're at the point of starvation. They have no other option. They have to go to Egypt to get some food. "And if I don't bring him back to you and let him before you bring him back before you, then let me bear the blame forever." And Jacob says, "Okay, all right, we'll have to let go. We're going to live. I have to do it." But Jacob says, "Bring a present, a mincha, to the man. Carry money with you back, and perhaps they'll see that it was an oversight along the way. So bring a gift of almonds and pistachios and all the fruit of the ground, even though they're starving, but give what we have to the pharaohs and to Joseph, to the man," he calls him, who is his son Joseph. "Take your brother also. May God Almighty grant you mercy before the man." Now this word present, mincha down here, is the same word that's used in Genesis 32 for what Jacob sent to Esau when he was reconciled to him. So it worked then, kind of a bribe or, you know, a goodwill offering, present, gift. It sort of softened Esau up. Finally, they did reconcile. He hopes maybe the same thing will happen with the man in Egypt as well. And then Genesis 43, Joseph welcomes the brothers and says, "We're going to have a big feast." Brothers can't believe it. "What? Us? You're going to have a feast with this great Egyptian, powerful Egyptian?" So Joseph says, "Slaughter an animal, make ready for the men to dine with me at noon." The men were afraid. They said, "Oh, this is just a trap. This is an opportunity for this official to make slaves of us and take all our donkeys. They're not trusting." When Joseph came home, the brothers brought him the present, the gift, the mincha that they had carried into the house, and they bowed down to the ground before him. Again, the dream is remembered, the brothers bowing down. In fact, it's coming true. He inquired about their welfare, and they say, "Your servant, our father, your servant, Joseph, your father. So here the father also, in a sense, symbolically bows down, as with the dream back that's there. And then Joseph looks up and sees his brother Benjamin for the first time, his mother's son, his one full brother. And then is overcome with affection for his brother and is about to weep, so he went into a private room and wept there. Joseph now just emotionally, viscerally is experiencing this homecoming, this coming together with his full brother. And so when they're seated before him at the feast, the brothers looked at one another in amazement. Holy cow, what are we doing here? Having all this feast that's here. Benjamin's portion was five times as much as any of theirs. That's fine, though. So they drank and were merry, and with him they had this party, this feast together. And then Joseph commanded the steward of the house, fill the men's sacks with food as much as they can carry, put the money that they paid back into each of the sacks, and, crucially, put my cup, the silver cup used for divination, in the top of the sack of the youngest Benjamin and with his money for the grain. Now, this is done. They're sent off, and then a steward of the house of Joseph comes back, runs after the brothers on the journey, and says, you have stolen the silver cup of my master. And then they say, absolutely not, we'd never do that, that's crazy. And they say, okay, whoever, you find out who's stolen it in their stuff, you can go through our stuff, and if you can find the silver cup, let the person with whom that cup is die. Moreover, the rest of us will become my Lord's slaves. They're so confident, nobody's taken the cup, but it's there. And then the Egyptian steward says, oh, it won't be that. So the one with whom it is found shall become my slave, according to Joseph, but the rest of you shall go free. So now here is the test. Of course, the cup is found in Benjamin's sack, and then all of them return back to the city. And so this scene, now they all come back. One can imagine this is Amigoni's portrayal of the scene. Joseph is here, the silver cup is there. This is Benjamin, Joseph's hands on young Benjamin. This is probably Judah, who is the one who's primarily speaking for other brothers that are there. And so now this second reunion, test number two, with a touch of mercy. Judah and his brothers come to Joseph's house, and they fell to the ground before him, yet again, the dream. Joseph said to them, what deed is this that you've done? Do you not know that one such as I can practice divination? I know everything. You can't get away with anything. And Judah says, what can we say to my Lord? What can we speak? How can we clear ourselves? God has found out the guilt of your servants. That sentence, God has found out the guilt of your servants. The guilt of stealing the silver cup, but perhaps also the guilt of having sold Joseph as a slave years ago. And so what they suggest is, here we are then, my Lord's slaves, both we and also the one in whose possession the cup has been found. But Joseph says, okay, here are the consequences. Only the one in whose possession the cup was found shall be my slave. But as for you, plural, go up in peace to your father. There's the temptation. The brothers can go back to their father, take the food, the money, but Benjamin has to stay. Will the brothers abandon their brother, Benjamin, favorite of their father, or not? And then the response, Judah stepped up literally and figuratively and says, let your servant please speak a word in my Lord's ears. Don't be angry, for you are like Pharaoh himself. Now therefore, when I, Judah, come to your servant, my father Jacob, and the boy, Benjamin, is not with us, then as his life is bound up with this boy's life, when he sees the boy is not with us, he will die. And so Judah realizes this will devastate his father if Benjamin does not come back. And so Judah recounts that he had pledged to his father he would bring him back, or he would have blame on his life, by his father, could be blamed all his life. Now, therefore, Judah says, let your servant Judah remain as a slave to my Lord in place of the boy Benjamin. Judah offers up his life, volunteers to sacrifice his life for the sake of Benjamin. Now, what's crucial here in this family system is that one of the unfavored has offered to sacrifice for the favored son, Benjamin, and is seeking reconciliation. There's a kind of crossing of a boundary here between the two. They were unwilling to do that with Joseph years and years ago, but now Judah steps forward and is willing to sacrifice his life for the sake of his brother, Benjamin. And so here's the turning point in this second meeting between the brothers. Joseph could no longer control himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, send everyone away from me. You know, all the Egyptians, get out of the room. and let just the brothers and Joseph be together. And Joseph reveals himself, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? And his brothers could not answer him, so dismayed were they at his presence. They knew their lives were in his hand, and he had the power to do and to take whatever revenge he chose to do. And they were dismayed. And Joseph says to his brothers, come closer to me. And they came closer, and Joseph says, I'm your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt, and now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. Joseph says, look, I know what you've done, but don't be dismayed, don't be angry with yourselves. God sent me here to preserve life and the life of his own family coming from Canaan, but also the life of Egyptians, the life of other nations as well. So it was not you who sent me here, but God, Joseph says. And then Joseph fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, while Benjamin wept upon his neck, and he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them, and after that his brothers talked with him. They were able finally to speak, and they sort of reconciled in that moment. Later in the story, Jacob is also brought back to Egypt, the father, and so Jacob sent Judah ahead to Joseph to lead the way before him into Goshen, and they came into the land of Goshen, and Joseph made ready his chariot, went up to meet his father there, and fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. And Jacob says to Joseph, I can die now, having seen for myself, you are still alive. So the story is a story of reconciliation. Now, there's other things that happen along the way, and it's a little more complicated. But at the very end of the story Jacob is about to die, and he gives his final blessing, his sort of last will and testament to each of his 12 sons, each of the 12 tribes. Genesis 49, Reuben, who's the firstborn, who's usually the favored one, but in the book of Genesis, the firstborn always not favored. It gets overturned all the time. And so you shall no longer excel, and there was a reason for that, but that's another story. Verse 10, but of Judah is exalted, the scepter, as ruler, Judah is the tribe from which David, the king from the tribe of Judah, the great King David, Solomon, and a whole line of kings of Judah, shall always be a ruler. The ruler's staff from between his feet will always be there. And there's five verses of positive blessing. Usually through these blessings, maybe each tribe or son gets one or two verses, but Judah gets five. And Joseph also gets five positive verses of blessing. And so these two represent in ancient Israel two different halves of the territory of Israel. The northern kingdom are the Joseph tribes, and the southern kingdom is Judah, the Judah tribe. And so this coming together of north and south and reconciliation between them. That's what this story is also about. a reconciliation, tribal, national, political, social, religious community coming together in a time of being dispersed, of being under the thumb of empires, being reconciled together and finding unity together in their faith in God. Now, I talked about the scientists who spoke of revenge and forgiveness, and there are these conditions that lessen revenge and make forgiveness more possible, ways in which this is enabled. One of those is that there's a signal from the person who has done the harm of words of a sincere apology. Where do we get that in the story? Where are there actual words of apology in the Joseph story? It's interesting, there's not directly, the brothers directly saying to Joseph, we're sorry. Yeah, exactly, and, which is overheard indirectly. So there's a kind of indirect, and what's interesting, in the Jacob-Esau story earlier, there was no direct word of, I'm sorry, that Jacob says to Esau, but there are other ways. And that's true in certain cultures. Some cultures do not sort of allow that kind of, or just, it's not part of their culture to directly say, I'm sorry to someone else. Or not. In our culture, yes, but not in others. But here's an overheard, indirect way in which the confession is heard. A second signal, gestures that express shame and remorse, bowing down and crawling. Again, in the story, somewhat indirectly, they're bowing down, but there is also a sense in which they acknowledge the power of this Egyptian official, but also in a way acknowledge their guilt before him as well. A third signal, paying some compensation, even if modest or only partial. Is there a compensation that's paid by the brothers to Joseph for what they've done to him in the story? Yes, in what way? Yes, yes, absolutely. He is willing to give up himself. So Joseph gives them money in their sex. But it's Judah's willingness. And that's what turns the whole. It's the willingness to sacrifice in that way. Another condition is the quality of the relationship. And so scientific studies of reconciliation, forgiveness, and so forth, it is easier to forgive those with whom we are closest, our siblings, close relationships, a friendship that's long-lasting, that's easier to forgive than someone we don't know well, than that we're not closely tied to in that way. Another condition is simply the amount of time since the original harm. And so this has been decades that Joseph has lived with this, and he also, what is important is to feel that you are protected and safe when you encounter a person who's harmed you, who's trying to ask for forgiveness. The other person who's been harmed feels protected, safe. So Joseph now is the one who has power and is protected and also has looked back over his life and seen how God has been working in that life through all the challenges that are there, finally, to bring a life in a positive way. And then sixth is simply the age of the one who forgives. The older you are, scientifically, in terms of research, the more likely you are to forgive. And they suggest one of the reasons is because you get older, you become more vulnerable, you need to build your social network more and more, and so you're more willing to forgive others as well. Now, it's no guarantee that this all happens in different situations. Sometimes there isn't reconciliation. There isn't possibilities of forgiveness. But sometimes there are as well. So, questions, comments, insights to think about as we look at the story.
It seems to me that there's this interesting hangover that the brothers, though this story of reconciliation, you know, we covered this to this point.
Yes.
There is this period, there's a conversation after the father.
That's right.
So it's not clear that they ever really accept or reconcile even at that point.
Yeah.
And there's this hangout.
Yeah, and fear. I mean, so, right? So in some ways, Jacob, the father, in some ways, is still their protector against Joseph. As long as he's alive, you know, Jacob will likely protect them. But once Jacob is gone, the father is alive, they're genuinely afraid again, right? So then what happens? Joseph has to repeat, no. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. But they're afraid, because they are still vulnerable, right? So in doing that, and I think it's okay to allow that open question: do they really fully reconcile? That's the nature of biblical narratives. Often in the Old Testament, is there isn't often the happy ever after ending, right? Well, what comes after this? Slavery, that's right, yeah. Joseph dies, and then the Pharaoh arises who did not know Joseph and says, look at these Hebrews that are here, they're enemies. A sort of echo of what Joseph had said about his brothers at the end. You're spies, you're here, you're dangerous, you're outsiders. Now Pharaoh does that as well. And then it goes into a horrible season of slavery for the Hebrews, for the Israelites, and then eventually exodus out of there and journey through the wilderness and on from there. So there is never a point in the biblical narrative where everything is happy ever after. There's always a challenge, there's always the hangover, there's lingering, which is true to human experience often, you know, that even when there is reconciliation, it's still not total, complete. And sometimes it is, but you can't guarantee it. And there are dangling threads sometimes. So that's the nature of the truth of these narratives in that kind of way. So
in other discussions, there's been a conversation about reconciliation not being complete until the person being forgiven is willing to accept that. So I see that in his brothers.
Yeah, right. They have to take it in. But just as it took time and some deep emotional work for Joseph to come to a point to embrace the brothers, and he had to sort of test them in their willingness to spare Benjamin. So forgiveness is not easy work. It's hard work, and it takes time and effort and building trust. That's what's going on here, right? And it can fall apart at any point, and it can't always be assured. You need to continue to work on it. So Joseph had to restate his commitment. No, I forgive you along the way. Other questions, comments? Yes, Nate.
Thanks for all of this. And I'm curious, somehow in your telling of the story this morning, I just feel the Cain and Abel story, like covering the whole thing. I wonder if you want to comment on that.
Absolutely. So the first brothers in the book of Genesis are Cain and Abel. And Cain's, in a sense, taking revenge on Abel for being bringing the favored sacrifice to God, and God rejecting Cain's own. In a sense, Cain should have taken revenge or been angry at God, but Cain takes it and aims it at Abel and has consequences. But God also puts some merciful conditions and preserves Cain's life, in some sense gives some degree of forgiveness, protecting him with a mark so no one takes revenge against him. And so it's wrestling there with the same dynamic of how does one forgive, but there are also consequences to disobedience, and how is that held together and preserves the human, sort of the human species in line in that kind of way. But this story is clearly an answer to the Cain and Abel story in the book of Genesis. That reconciliation.
Am I my brother's keeper, right?
Yes. Yes. Right, right, yeah. And that question that Cain asks in some ways is an accusation against God. Because in the Old Testament, the one who keeps people, keeps Israel, it protects, guards them, is God. So am I my brother's keeper? No, you are God. So if anything happened to my brother Abel, it's on you. So it's an accusing kind of thing. Yes?
Here's the story of the first welfare system. It didn't work out too well either.
What's that?
Cain and Abel maybe was the first welfare system. It did not work out too well either.
In what way? I mean, I don't... Oh, I'm on my brother's keeper. Yeah. So, well, I think the story in the whole book of Genesis is, yes, we are. I mean, if you look at what Joseph does in the story through the dreams, Joseph sees what's coming, the catastrophe that's about to come, a natural catastrophe of famine, drought, and stores up grain, has all the Egyptians together to store up grain so that together as a community we can survive the 7 years of starvation that are about to happen. So there's a kind of communal sort of keeping, you know, am I a brother's keeper? Yeah, we are brothers and sisters, all of us together in this. And not only for us Egyptians, but also for other nations as well. And that's the answer to Cain and Abel in that way. So, I mean, I think the biblical response, am I my brother's keeper, is God is, but God uses us to keep one another, to care for one another. That's how God does it. And so God uses, in the Joseph story, Joseph and his insights and his capacity to organize all of this together to preserve life. For the flourishing of the whole community and of others outside the community, outside the nation of Egypt as well. So it's a story about the capacity of human beings to adapt to crisis by joining together, cooperating, collaborating, reconciling with one another, coming together in the face of a catastrophe that's looming. And I think one can bring that to our own time and place in thinking about the challenges that lay before us that are deep and threatening in many ways. And so it goes on, but and in the end, I think both scientifically, but also in terms of scripture, there is hope. That God is working in, with, and through, and that hope gives us power and agency to move forward, knowing that we're not alone and that there are forces larger than us that are seeking the flourishing of life among us, but also among others as well. So. All right, we're up to time. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be with you, and best wishes.
Thank you so much to Dr. Olson for being here today and teaching us. And please join us next week for Dr. James Vanderkam teaching on reunion with Torah. Thanks. Great. Again, Dr. Olson.
Thank you.